¿Qué tal? Buenas noches a todos, bienvenidos. Es un honor para nosotros tener a la revolucionaria Lisa Bulo aquí, viene de Denver, tiene más de 25 años trabajando en Yiddishkeit y es la third time in Mexico City,
yeah. Uh-huh.
La tercera vez aquí que viene a México y tenemos el gusto de tener acá y vamos a escuchar algo muy nuevo, muy nuevo. What happened after we die?
Right, okay, good. Ready?
All yours.
Excellent, thank you. I'm sorry I'm not speaking Spanish to you. You'll have to all speak slowly. If there's any words or anything that you want me to translate or somebody else to translate, please just wave your hand and I can review the information. Okay, tonight's topic is not just what happens after we die, but the soul and the afterlife, what happens after we die. So I want to start with the soul. So we all know that the us of us is a soul, the actual essence of us. I was just reading in Aryeh Kaplan's book today, and Aryeh Kaplan, of course, passed away over 2 decades ago. So he writes about science that's old science at this point, but still cutting edge. So he just poses the question, what would happen if, today we already do heart transplants, what if there's a brain transplant, right? Who is the person? Is the person the brain of the old person or the body of the person that holds the brain? When you say, who am I, who is that person? The brain from the dead guy in the motorcycle accident or the body from the live guy that had brain cancer? So it's hard to know who is me. And even to make it more difficult than that, what if there was a clone? And they took a stem cell and they cloned it, or any cell, cloned it into an entire human being, adult, and had a blank brain. But if the adult would be the exact twin of me, look exactly like me, right? Because it'd be my clone. And then, we're all familiar with memory transfers today. What if you could download my entire hard drive onto a flash drive and upload it into that clone? Then who's me? Are they me just as much as I'm me? It's a real question. What makes me me? So the Jewish answer to what makes me is my soul. My body and my brain and all my organs hold my soul, but that's not really who I am. Eventually, all of that is going to die and return back to dust, but my soul lives on forever. So what is my soul? What is a soul in its essence? So tonight I'm going to be sharing wisdom from the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, from his book, Derech Hashem, The Way of God. And he explains it pretty straight out. So the soul. The soul is the animating force of every living creature. Turns out there are two souls when we talk about human beings. But we're going to start out with the soul that all living creatures share. And that is the nefesh. It's called the nefesh. Nefesh also means life. But here it means the thing that makes you alive. So dogs have it, snakes have it, mice have it. I'm not sure if trees and plants have it, but for sure all creatures have it, and human beings have it also, a nefesh. If you poke a hole in a body that's a big enough hole, the blood comes out and the nefesh comes out with it, and the body's no longer alive, right? So, or illness, well, however somebody dies. But it's the nefesh that makes somebody alive. In the nefesh is most of the basic character traits that we would think of even as being human. Curiosity, some drive, some desire to make things happen, the desire for food, for friendship, for connection, all of that is in the animal soul, the nefesh that we have. But human beings, all human beings, Jews and non-Jews, have something more than that, and it's called the neshama. Now, I'm going to get a little bit confusing in talking about the neshama, because there's a lot of different language in neshama. Neshama, neshama, however you pronounce it. Neshama is the soul. Turns out that the soul, when we talk about the human soul, it actually has 5 levels. Now, this is only one construct. You should know that there's lots of other ways to understand souls, too, that work along with this. But one way, basic way, that our Kabbalists talk about soul is the neshama has 5 different levels. Now, to make it extra confusing, I'll tell you those levels, but the first level is called nefesh. That nefesh of the first level of the neshama is not the same as the nefesh that's the nefesh of the animating force of the body. So the 5 levels of the human soul, and all together, the whole thing is called neshama, is nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida. All those five levels together are called together neshama, even though the bottom one, nefesh, is the same as nefesh, and even though the middle one, neshama, is the same name as the whole thing. Right? Can we get that so far? Okay. Those levels of the soul have each one has a different function. Nefesh comes from the word nofesh, or holiday, rest, relaxation, right? It rests. The nefesh is the part of the soul that rests up against the edge of your body, so to speak. So it's the part that comes in contact with you. It's the part that's connected to the nefesh, the animating force that's making you alive. Next comes the ruach. The ruach means wind or spirit. Spirit is another word that we use for souls, right? The spirit of a person, ruach. We would talk about the spirit of Hashem, ruach Elokim merachefet, right? The spirit of Hashem hovers over the face of the deep in the beginning of Bereishit. So the ruach. Ruach, though, by its nature, is unstable. It moves. It blows around. So the ruach part of the soul is a part that moves. It mediates. What does it mediate? What does it communicate between? It communicates between the nefesh, the lowest level, and the neshama, the middle level. The neshama is, that middle level, is usually what we're referring to when we refer to our soul. It's that part is our spiritual aspirations, our desire to become excellent like God is excellent, our desire to seek and achieve perfection like God is perfect. Our desire to connect to the divine is in the neshama. So, but that's not something that we always feel. But it is something that's very important for us to feel because that's what makes us human. Otherwise, we're just glorified animals. Rav Hirsch discusses the difference between plants and animals and humans. So plants, their basic function is they're alive. They eat. They reproduce. They also give off waste, but their waste is in the form of stuff that we breathe. We don't think of it as waste, right? But they eat and they reproduce. That's their job, right? Animals do the same thing. They eat, they reproduce, they have waste also, except for they can move around. But why do they move around? Only so they can eat better and reproduce better, right? They don't really have any other goal other than eating and procreating. That's their main thing. So really, animals are a glorified plant. They can just do it better than plants can do it. Now the question is, who are we? We're a step above animals. We can speak. Right? We're actually, as Jews, two steps above animals because human beings are a step above and Jews go after that in terms of spiritual species. We are a different species. But human beings, let's talk about human beings. So all human beings are created in the image of God, Jews and non-Jews. All human beings can aspire to much higher and can fall much lower. So the question is, what does the human being choose to do with its extra strengths? So certainly communication, verbal communication in a very strong way is an extra strength that a human being has. Bees can communicate, tell each other where the good flowers are, or elephants can communicate compassion and take care of their elderly, but nothing communicates like human beings do. So human beings have that extra ability to communicate, extra ability to think and create and destroy. But the question is, are we behaving like glorified animals? Do we use our abilities, all our extra abilities, just to be able to eat, satisfy our needs, procreate better than a plant, better than an animal? Or do we channel all of our energies in a different direction so that we use our physical needs and processes in order to serve something higher? That's a choice that every human being gets to make. It's not necessarily a foregone conclusion. Somebody has to choose each and every lifetime, and usually each and every day, how they'll use their energy to be a glorified plant, basically an animal, or above and beyond that. As Jews, we're even past that level. We have an extra ability, stronger, and it's a very subtle ability, but an extra ability for spiritual connection. Jews have the ability to transfer energies through their souls that actually can change the entire world. Every human being has the ability to emulate God through their neshama. The desire comes through their neshama, that middle level, to emulate God. And then every human being has the ability to use all of their lower capacities to achieve something higher and perfect themselves in the pursuit of the divine. Every human being can accomplish that. Jews have that job, and in addition to that job, they have the job of not just perfecting self, but perfecting the whole world. The whole world is ours to perfect. And as the firstborn of Hashem, we've been called that, the chosen people are the firstborn. Are we the firstborn? Are we the first nation? We're not, right? We're not the first nation on the planet, and yet we are called the firstborn of Hashem. What is the firstborn? So I don't know how many of you are firstborns or have firstborns, but the firstborn, at least in my family, and Rav Hirsch describes that in many families, the firstborn is the one that's kind of in between parent and child. The one that's really the right hand of the parent kind of does some helping. When my kids were little, I had 6 children in 7.5 years. So my oldest daughter, yeah, right? So I had one set of twins in there. But so my oldest daughter, the kids called me Ima, and sometimes they even called her Mommy. Right? So we're two different mothering figures to the young children. My husband was then an attorney, very busy in his life, and she really helped me a lot. Even when she was little, when I had the twins, she was 4 years old. And she helped, she would hold one while I bathed the other, hold the other while I fed the other. One night at 9 o'clock, I had put her to bed already, and I'm struggling, both the babies are crying. And she was 4.5. She said, Ima, should I get up and come help you? Right? That's the role of the firstborn. The role of the firstborn is to communicate the desires of the parent to the other children and to help the parent with the other children. We're the firstborn of Hashem. It doesn't mean the other nations aren't important. They're Hashem's children. But we're the ones who are supposed to teach and lead the way how everybody can create a relationship with the divine, how the whole world can reach a place of synergy and effectiveness where we all work together. It's our job to pave that path and shed that light into everyone. So that's the special job of the Jew. But meanwhile, all human beings have this middle level, this neshama level, which is the level through which we perceive and strive towards the divine. Above that is Chaya and Yechida. Those are the two levels that we don't usually feel at all. Only the most spiritually sensitive person can feel them. And most of those spiritually sensitive people were the types that were Nevi'im. Even the Nevi'im, even the prophets, that didn't write down their prophecies. But we're told that during the temple times, they had schools for Nevi'im. There were over 1 million prophets. Only a few of them wrote their prophecies down, because what got written down was only the prophecies that made a difference for us today. The ones that were eternal prophecies. But the concept of being a Navi, the fact that there were Navi schools, means that the person was able to get in touch with the higher essence of their soul and be able to use those higher levels to connect with the divine. Who here has heard of Yeshivas Shem Ve'Ever? Right? A few people have heard of it. So that's the yeshiva that Yaakov went to before he went into Laban's house. So before he spent all that time in Laban's house, he went to learn in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever for 14 years. What was he learning in that yeshiva? A lot of people think about a Beis Medrash the same way we have a Beis Medrash today, lined with books, tables, everybody sitting, talking and learning, shouting over the Gemara, right? There was no Gemara at that time. There were no commentaries at that time. There were no Kabbalah works at that time. There was no Torah at that time. There was no Navi at that time. There were no books at that time. He spent 14 years in the yeshiva learning what? Right. He spent 14 years learning what we today would mistakenly call, and I don't really want to call it this because it doesn't mean it all the way, Eastern philosophy. The concepts of living with God in your every breath, living in a way that's present with Hashem, where every action that you do integrates Hashem into your life, and not only brings Hashem in, but shines Hashem out. He needed to study that for 14 years before he went into the home of Tumah that was Laban's, so he could fortify himself to be able to withstand the test of Laban's home and choose his wives and leave. But imagine studying that for 14 years and studying how the soul works and how to live in the neshama. That's what he was doing. So the upper two levels, Chaya and Yechida, are not levels that we usually perceive at all. That being said, however, they still exert an influence on us. So what happens with the soul? So we walk around with our souls all day long, and they're sort of like in links. Imagine a chain with links on the chain. So the neshama is five links, and the links are together. If you would hold it up from the top, they would drop down, each one touching the next. So they are connected, each one to the next. And then the bottom link, the nefesh level, is connected to the nefesh in the body, the animating life force, the animal soul. That nefesh is connected to us through our blood. So that's how it's attached, is through our blood, so to speak. That's its attachment, is through the blood. So now, we walk through the day, carrying our soul around, feeling it to the extent that we feel, and then we go to sleep. What happens when we go to sleep? So we've all experienced dreams that we wonder, what did that dream mean? Was it a piece of prophecy? Was it just a strange thing? Was it a premonition? Was it a weird story? Was it just processing what happened in the day? So the answer is most dreams are just processing. Most dreams are just nonsense or just thinking about whatever was going on. But some dreams have little bits of messages in them. Those messages come through the mechanism of the soul being loosened from its bonds while we sleep. The Gemara says that when we sleep, we're like 1/60th dead. What does 1/60th mean? It's not an actual measurement. Just like when we say we go, when we visit somebody who's sick, we take away 1/60th of their illness. But it's not an actual measurement. If you think about the concept of 1/60th, 1/60th trafe in something kosher, it's still kosher, right? That's the amount that means it's real enough, it's enough that it changes it from one to another, right? So it's still there. 1/60th is something that you could perceive, but it's not enough to change the status of something. That's why you could have up to 1/60th non-kosher in a kosher product and it's still kosher. It doesn't change the status. So just like that, when we take away 1/60th of their illness, we didn't change their status to healthy. When we go to sleep and we're 1/60th dead, we don't change our status to dead. We're still alive. But there is a part of that. So what is that that happens that's 1/60th of death? So if we'll define death, and I will define death this way, the separation of body and soul, right? Because the soul lives forever, the body does not. When the body expires, that's called death, there's a disassociation of body and soul. That's what we call death. So what's happening when we sleep is that the bonds of the soul are loosened, and it's particularly those upper realms, but sometimes even all four upper realms, not the bottom nefesh of the neshama, but the upper four realms, those bonds can be loosened, even though they're linked on a chain, but they can travel into spiritual realms while we're sleeping. They can travel according to who we are and how we behave. So the way that we've behaved, in essence, gives those neshama parts a visa. It gives them an entry into a spiritual realm. And it also creates, imagine just a kite string, it also creates the length of kite string that allows them to travel. So they're still connected through that string, and they can travel around in the upper realms. They may be able to travel high, but if they don't have a visa to enter a certain spiritual realm, so to speak, then they can't. So the length, their ability to travel and their ability to interact with other spiritual forces that are in upper realms is dictated by how one behaves and who one is, meaning how they've created themselves, what they've done with their soul during the day, how they've allowed that soul to inform their body during the day. So there's a cumulative effect during the days, and then there's also the daily effect, how you were that day. It's a very complicated mathematical formula, not one that I understand. Fortunately, God keeps track of all of that, so he's the one who figures it out, right? But our soul's bonds are loosened. So since the bond is loosened with our body, that's considered 1/60th death, even though it's still connected, but the bond is loosened. When it comes back down, or even when it's still up, some of what it learns in those upper realms can filter down from stage to stage to stage to stage, eventually until some of those ideas come into the nefesh level of the neshama, and then even into the nefesh level of the body, and that's translated through the imagination into dreams. Most dreams, even if they have real things in it, have a lot of non-real things in it, so it's hard to tell what's real and what's not. We don't have real prophecy today, but that would be one way that prophecy could work, and that's where a whole dream would be real. But for us, we don't experience that today, but we do sometimes experience some Ruach HaKodesh, where some of that that comes in is real, but it's always mixed with things that are not real. Now, in those upper realms, there are two types of spiritual entities that it's possible to engage with, positive ones and negative ones. Each one of them can teach things and impart ideas that can come down. So only the positive ones can teach things that are true. The negative ones that it is possible to come into contact with teach things that are not true or are tricking. So we have to be careful of that too. Which side does the information come from? And that also depends on how we've created ourselves, where we have access. And it just parenthetically, just be careful where you learn meditation techniques from, because you can learn a technique that's very powerful that accesses a wrong dimension. So it would be important to learn it from somebody who understands enough to teach a Jew the proper way for a Jew to meditate, as opposed to just learning any technique. The techniques can be powerful. Okay, so that's the soul, right? So now we have the soul, so now we understand some of the anatomy of the soul. So where is this soul first created? I can't tell you. One concept is that it's created in the dat of Hashem, whatever that means. Right? There's different spiritual realms, but apparently the soul is created in dat and then comes into the body. Right? So it comes into the body. The word for that in English is ensoulment. So many different religions have a question of when does ensoulment occur. The Catholics believe that ensoulment happens upon conception. We believe that it happens at 40 days, 40 days after conception. So at 40 days after conception, that's when the developing body receives its soul. And then it starts to, we have a tradition also that it starts to learn Torah at that time, when there's a malach that comes and teaches it Torah until it's born, and then it gets hit right here. That's why you have this little dip. Right, it gets hit in the lip, and then you forget the Torah, but you learned it so that you should be able to recognize it when you learn truth afterwards. That makes it recognizable. So, okay, so our soul before we're born, the soul is created before ensoulment occurs. It's then dipped into a body. It wears the body for however long we get to be alive. And then the soul floats back out again, leaving the body behind. We call that death. How does the soul separate? So we've all talked to people who've experienced death. I don't mean them themselves, but have known people who have died, or most of us, some of us have been with somebody who has died, but we've all come into some kind of contact with death. Some deaths are easy, some deaths are difficult. The Talmud uses the expression of the two ends of the spectrum. The way it describes it is an easy death is like slipping a hair out of a bowl of milk. It just slides right out. And a difficult death is like removing the seed from cotton. It has to be pulled. Has anybody ever tried to do that? When you get cotton, it has a seed in it, and it's so hard to take it out. You have to pull very hard, and a lot of times it really holds on to the seed very tightly. You have to really, really pull to get it out. That's a difficult death, when you have to pull that hard to get the neshama out of the body. What makes the difference between how the neshama leaves the body? There's a lot of different reasons that the neshama could leave a body in a different way. One, only one of the reasons is the attachment to the physical that the person developed while they were alive. So if a person is very involved in the physical, really enjoys the physical, is really attached to the physical, to material possessions, to lots of food, to whatever it is, but the more attached they are, the more attached they are to the physical. Yeah. And the harder it is to pull that soul out of the body. Not only that, but it makes for a different experience after death as well, which we'll talk about in a minute. So the less attached, the easier the separation can be. The more attached, the more difficult it can be. But that's not the only reason. There's other reasons too. It's not just about attachment. So it's very important when learning these things not to quickly file through in your mind all the people that you know who died and think, oh, those who had the easy deaths, they were the not attached. And those who had the difficult deaths, they were the attached people. So don't do that because there's a lot more involved. One of the other factors that's involved is reward and punishment. Reward and punishment. So we are paid for everything that we do. It is impossible to do anything and not accrue some type of recompense for that. Some type of response will come for everything that we do, no matter how big or small. So everything, good or bad, big or small, there is something that's going to come as a result of that. Now, depending on how a person leads their life, they can make choices to change their past. It is possible, and particularly during this month of Elul, it is possible to actually hit the delete button for real. It's not painting it over, it's not white out, it's actually deleting it from reality through tshuva. That is the way. So anything that you're sorry that you did or wish you hadn't done, it is possible to eradicate it. Possible. It's difficult, depends on how you work with that in your life, but it is possible to eradicate it through tshuva. If it was not eradicated through tshuva, there's two other ways to get rid of it. Because it has to be gotten rid of. Anything negative has to leave the soul before eternity can start for the soul. Because eternity is only positive. Only. And you only get pleasure in eternity. Only. But have to be paid for everything. So the other two ways to get the negativity out, because the negativity has to be removed from your soul. Whatever you incorporate it in, it has to be cut out. You can cut it out yourself through tshuva, or Hashem can help on this side of the dividing line in this world through suffering. So different types of suffering can remove negativity. Or, on the other side of the line, the worst of the three options is Gehenna. Gehenna happens right after somebody dies, and it's a soul hospital, where you go to the hospital, and you get sliced open, and your tumor is removed. So anybody here who's had surgery knows it's uncomfortable, or very painful. But after the doctor cuts you and removes and sews you back up, and you wake up, what do you say to the doctor? Thank you, right? Because you know what he did was good. And so Gehenna is also a good thing, but extremely painful. All of it has to be removed. So it's much easier, actually, the easier surgery is suffering here. The easiest is tshuva here. The easiest of the three options. But one of those three for sure will happen for everything negative that anybody has done. It has to happen. So that being said, one of the things that can lead to a more difficult death process can be the suffering that's necessary, particularly for somebody who's done a lot of good in the world. It may be that just a longer death or a more painful death can be what they need to remove any negativity that's left over so they get to skip Gehenna altogether. So that's why I said don't think, and that's only the second one of the many things that can affect how somebody dies. So but those are two major places that can affect it. So don't start calculating. Everybody's done bad things. Everybody has to figure out how to get those bad things out of their soul. And Hashem helps, because it will happen. There's no question. Except for those who completely ruin everything. Their souls are just destroyed through a long process of destruction. So there are some of those, like a Hitler, or anybody like that. So they didn't do enough good to be redeemed at all. Their soul is just destroyed. But it's a very long destruction process so that he can be repaid for everything that he did. Because he needs payment. So that takes a long time to repay him all the negativity. Okay, so now we have the soul has come into the body and the soul has left the body. So now the question is, and a question that's important to think about is, what's the point? If you're going to come in, you're going to go out. So why come in at all, right? So for a different talk, really the whole point is transformation of soul. The soul cannot transform itself. The soul cannot enter into a relationship with God by itself. It has to have a body, and it has to have a physical arena. It has to have a body as a tool and a world in which to make choices. Every choice chooses you closer or further from God. Every single choice. So if it's a big choice or a little choice, but every choice chooses you further or closer. There is no power of choice. Everything is closer or further, a lot or a little. So that's what the world's for, choosing in or choosing out at every moment, basically. So that's what we're here for, is soul transformation. But let's continue with our topic of the evening, the journey. Okay, so now, we've moved, this soul that we're talking about has crossed the line and is now dead. What does that mean? Death is disassociation of body and soul. The beginning stages of disassociation are very confusing for the soul. So particularly, until the body is buried, the soul is in some level of pain, being disconnected from its physical place where it was sheltered for so long. So that is one reason why, as Jews, we bury very quickly as we can, because we want to end that stage for the soul. So the soul is in a confused state until burial, and it's also right there watching whatever happens right after death. How the body is treated, how people are in the room. That's why we have a custom, even if somebody is watching a body, we have a custom to watch the bodies. Really, that custom is so it won't be eaten by mice before burial. That's why. I mean, even if there's no mice around, but we have that custom. That's why we sit shmira for bodies, is to protect it from things before it goes into the grave. But we want to give as much honor and respect to the body. So something that we don't do while we're watching a body, or even shortly after death, if people are still standing around, we don't do a mitzvah. We don't make a bracha on food, or speak words of Torah, or joke, even. No words of levity, certainly, but also no words of Torah or mitzvahs right then, because they can't do it. And now they know, they wish they had it. So we don't want to, in a way, tease the newly dead person that they can no longer fulfill a mitzvah by doing a mitzvah in front of them. So we try to take care of the body as nicely as possible. There's a whole tahara process, which involves washing the body in a ritual way. I did one once. I had that experience, which is a fascinating experience to have. After you do it, and there's a specific way to do it, and all kinds of Kabbalistic rituals to do, also knots to tie and things to say, and the way that it's done. After you've done it, and when you wash the body, you wash each limb, but you keep it covered, sort of like when you get a massage, somebody gives you a massage and they just uncover one limb, work on that, cover it back up, uncover another one, so that the body's not naked all at once, except for when you either dip it in the mikvah at the end or pour over the tishah kabim, 9 measures of water over it. It has to be naked for that. So you've seen the body naked, which is embarrassing for the body, for the soul of the body. So afterwards, that you ask mechila, you ask for forgiveness from the body for treating it that way. That we do have to do it, but we do ask forgiveness from the meat. Then it's wrapped and it goes into the coffin and it's buried. The burial is when the first place of rest of the neshama, but it's still not resting. After the burial, the neshama, in general, goes to a shiva house, which is why, even if somebody's sitting shiva alone, and even if your Hebrew is good, you don't bless them at the end by saying, "Hamakom yinachem otcha v'toch shar avlitzion." You say etchem, even if it's one person by himself, because you are also comforting the soul of the departed. The soul of the departed is there, and the soul of the departed is feeling quite similarly to those in the room, missing the connection to the body, and missing the connection that the body affords to connect to other people. So the soul also needs to be comforted during that week of Shiva. After the week of Shiva, or during the week of Shiva, the body starts to decay. And the feelings of decay, according to our sages, can be felt to the extent that the person was connected to their body. So that depends on each individual person. Somebody who is a very spiritual person will feel it much less than somebody who's a very physical person. So that there is that decay process. But then slowly the soul starts to elevate. Now what happens to the soul at this point? There's a machloket between the Rambam and the Ramban. I'm going with the Ramban here, but I'll just quickly tell you what the Rambam says. So the Rambam says the soul then, after its period of Gehenna, because that's when Gehenna would start if it has to go to Gehenna, right? Is I think after the Shiva, it doesn't go immediately. It gets this day around and then into Gehenna for its soul cleansing period, for however long it needs to be cleansed, and then out, and then Olam Haba, according to the Rambam. So the Rambam says that's when the next world begins. He also believes in resurrection, so he believes that there is an interruption in Olam Haba for the resurrection to occur, where the soul comes back into a body, is resurrected, then all physical things have to come to an end, so that new body also dies, but it's not the same kind of difficult death at all, so a very easy separation, back to Olam Haba forever. That's the Rambam's view. But most of the Kabbalists hold differently, and since we're tonight talking about the Ramchal's vision, so he shares the vision with the Ramban. So what happens next is Gehenna. After that, Olam Haba can't start yet, because Olam Haba is the end of everything. So at this point, could be there's Gehenna, or it could be there's reincarnation right away also. We do believe in reincarnation, which we can talk about a little bit more soon, if you remind me. So it could be that you go right back into reincarnation, which is not a pleasant experience. Most of us, by the way, are considered reincarnations, which is why most of us have so much stuff going on in our lives. Nobody's clean of the static of what most people are experiencing today. Everybody has something, or a lot of somethings. And that's just because most of us are reincarnations finishing up old stuff, which we could talk about. So there's reincarnation, or there's Gehenna, and then after that, there's what's called the Olam HaNeshamot. The soul is supposed to be able to be a giver. The soul was also created in the image of God, not just the body. The body somehow has its own image of God. It's not just the soul. The soul also has it. So the soul is supposed to be able to give. Even though we call the soul neshama, the soul is actually the masculine half of the body and soul connection. The body being the feminine, the receiver of the neshama's energy, the neshama, even though it's a feminine name, being the masculine, the giver of energy. What's supposed to happen is that the soul purifies and rarefies, or at least transforms the body through its behavior. So that every time the soul informs the body, and the body does what the soul says, the body's transformed because of what it did. So really, theoretically, we should be able to look at each other and know exactly what our spiritual level is, each other's spiritual level. It should be absolutely clear, written in our bodies, right? Imagine how scary that would be if everybody could totally see exactly who you are and what you've accomplished, right? However, it was held back by divine decree after the sin of Adam and Chava, so that our bodies are no longer transformed by our souls. But the soul is still designed to be able to change the body. But it can't. So basically what happens is, the way that you can imagine it is, the soul is wound up like a spring. Every time the soul influences the body to do something positive, it gets wound up tighter and tighter and tighter, with more and more potential energy stored into the soul. But it's sort of like a muscle in a cast. If you've ever had a broken limb, and you put a cast on, 8 weeks later when you take the cast off, that limb is a little thinner and a little weaker than the other one. Hopefully it will recover, but it takes a while to recover after it's been in a cast, held back from being able to behave the way it usually behaves, right? So the soul is sort of, in a way, in a cast inside the body, held back from being able to behave the way it's supposed to behave. After the period of purification, it goes to the Olam HaNeshamot, where it relaxes and starts to, sort of like a fluorescent light bulb, it starts to shine brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter until it achieves its shining potential. Then there's the resurrection, and that soul comes back into the new body. That's when all that potential energy of the soul completely transforms the new body. And that's when we can see exactly who each other is. gets dropped into the body. So the resurrection comes from whatever we bury in the ground, sort of like a tulip bulb. Right? We bury a flower bulb, and then a flower comes up the next spring. That flower doesn't look anything like what you put in the ground, right? And yet, it came from it. That's what happens. We plant our bodies in the ground like a bulb, and then what comes up in the resurrection is a flower that's related to that body, but isn't that body. It's not like our body gets out of the grave, but it's related to our body, just like the flower is related to the bulb. That's what comes up. But it's still just a hulk of physicality until the soul gets dropped back in it. And then instantly it's transformed according to the exact specifications of the soul energy that's there. Then there's that period that exists for however long, and that's unclear. Unclear to me, anyway. And following that is another, my understanding is following that is another separation, although there are people who say that that physical body is a perfect and perfected physical body and never needs to be shed again. So two schools of thought. It could be shed later on, an easier death, and then there's forever after that. Or you live forever with that extremely ethereal, perfected physical body that goes exactly perfectly with your soul, that lives forever. But it's not a body that ever needs to eat or consume or procreate or do anything like that. It's just a support for the soul. So that's basically where it's headed. Now that I told you that, I'll just confuse you a little bit more. Okay? Let's talk about reincarnation for a minute. Okay? So we have this concept of this of the body and the soul. The body's buried and the soul separates, right? And now that soul is going to become, maybe, will become reincarnated. Reincarnation only happens for those souls that need it and deserve it, right? So if the soul has accomplished enough that it deserves to come back, but it hasn't accomplished enough that it still needs to come back, that's when it gets to be reincarnated. So, okay, so does that make sense so far? Yeah? Okay, now let's make it complicated. Okay, so the first question that you can ask is, well, if I'm reincarnated, then whose wife am I really? Right? Am I the wife of my husband now? Am I the wife of my husband in my next life? Am I the wife of a husband in a previous life? When we all get resurrected, whose wife will I be? Right? Okay, that's question number one. That's very confusing, okay? But let's make it even more confusing than that. It turns out we don't have a nice, clean soul. Nice, clean, one piece of a soul. It turns out that we have something more like soul chips that can be stacked in different ways. Right, so just imagine, and how do we know this? We talk about the 600,000 souls that received the Torah at Mount Sinai. And yet we know, through our calculations, that there were about 3 million Jews there. Right, so the Kabbalah books talk about 600,000 Jewish souls. That's it, 600,000. Except for there's a lot more Jews than that in the world right now, and there's a lot more Jews than that in the cemeteries right now. So basically you have to take all the Jews in the cemeteries, all the Jews that are alive now, and all the Jews that will be born until the end of time, take that number and divide it into 600,000, and each of us has one of those pieces. Except for, we have to divide that number, divide the same number by a much higher number than however many Jews there were, are, and will be, because we actually have pieces of each other's neshamas in us too. So it could be that my current neshama, let's just take however many Jews there ever were, are, and will be, and multiply it by 10, whatever that number is. Divide that number, multiplied by 10, into 600,000. That's how many soul chips there are. Maybe I have 10 soul chips in me right now. Maybe I only have 7. Maybe I have 70. Maybe somebody else has 1, or 5, or 4, or 30. But it's all stacked in different configurations. When the soul separates from the body, what we call death, and then it gets reincarnated, let's just take a person with 30 chips in them. Maybe 15 go into one and 15 go into another, or 3, 3, 3, and 3, and 3 into different people. But anyway, it gets mixed up. So when you get reincarnated, it's much more complicated than it could seem, and resurrection also. So how does all that work? I can't tell you how it works. I just want to confuse you. I just want to give you lots of questions to think about and continue research. I don't know all the answers. I'm sharing with you what I know. But I know that it's much more complicated than one nice, clean half soul that you are, and you get married and you make your two halves together, and that becomes one and great, right? It's much more complicated than that. But part of that is because Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Lazeh. All Jews are, what does Arev mean? Mixed in. We're mixed, right? It's a whole mixture. We're mixed with each other. So we think of ourselves as being separate, all of us in this room, because we have skin that surrounds our soul piece. But the truth is, if you could see past the physical, you'd see we're all totally connected. And you know we are. We're one family across the world. You know how Jews are. It's so amazing. My friend told me she made Aliyah. She's in her early 60s. She's walking across the street, and she fell. Before she hit the ground, somebody was there to put something under her head. Somebody else was there with a bottle of water. Somebody else was there asking her why at her age she's wearing heels that high. Somebody else wanted to know where she lived, and a fifth person told her that he could get her an apartment for half the price and twice the rooms. So that's the way we are. We are one family. We are all mixed together. I know somebody called directory assistance in Israel to ask for the name, for the location of a restaurant. And the operator said, that restaurant? You don't want that restaurant. Try this restaurant. That's just the way we are. We're one big family. So one big family supports each other and drives each other crazy. But that's who we are, connected to each other. And so all those soul chips, that's why we are responsible for each other. That's why when we say al chet shechatan nu, it's in the plural, even if we didn't do it. Right? Because we're saying al chet on what the other parts of our soul, our one big collective soul, did. And the 600,000, that's even separated out from one proto-soul of Abraham and Sarah. So we are all one, and all 600,000, but in the essence, we're all one. Right? So Yisrael, Kutcha, Bricho, and Torah, Araita, Chadhu, right? We're all one. The Torah is one, Hashem is one, and the nation of Israel is one. And in the oneness, when we can achieve unity with each other, so then we emulate Hashem, that will create not the distance that we're experiencing now, Galut, we call that Galut, Galus.
And I'll switch that for you.
We call the current separation between Jews and God is exile, that's what it is, right? So we need to get ourselves back together and need to get Hashem back with us, and that's how we do it, is when we see that our souls are all connected to each other. So this is the month of Elul, this is the time when we can really look at our soul, assess our soul, take some time alone with our soul, and try to feel some of those higher levels, and try to strive into those higher levels and say, Hashem, I want to reach you through this and I want to fix what I damaged. We have actually a very special time coming up starting next week. I think it's starting Sunday, maybe before then. It's the 25th of Elul it starts. What day is today? Does anybody know today's date? In Elul. Well, starting, look, check your Jewish calendars when you get home.
22nd.
So in 3 days, today's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Shabbos. So starting Shabbos, right? Or Friday?
Friday.
Starting Friday is the 25th.
Friday night Shabbos
is the 25th of Elul. The 25th of Elul is the first parallel, the first day of creation. Because we know that Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of the world. The birthday of the world isn't from the first day that the world came into existence, but it's when it finished being born, right? So we don't count the moment when a mother's giving birth. We don't count when the head exits as the moment of birth. We count when the toes exit, right? When the last bit of the baby comes out, that's when the baby's born. So the world is considered born after Adam gets a soul. That's Friday afternoon. But the birth process began with the first day. So there's a six-day birth process. A six-day period of the world being created. We have the ability to tap into that creation energy to transform our souls during that time, to transform our whole world during that time, starting Friday night, Shabbos, from the 25th of Elul through Rosh Hashanah, is a time of tremendous, powerful transformation where we can change our whole world. So it's important at this point to do a Cheshbon HaNefesh, or actually, a little advertisement, doing a Cheshbon HaNefesh in 2 days in Cuernavaca, right? Where we'll be doing an assessment, a personal soul assessment, looking at who we are and how we want to grow. But this is an important time of the year to get in touch with your soul and think about the next world that you are creating here. Because the next world is a reality, and it's created right here. It can't be created there. This is the world of creation. That's the world of living in what you created. So this is the place where you want to pay attention to your soul and see how could you make the changes that you want to make to create the future that you want to live in. Right? So you can do that for right here and now. How can you invest in your marriage, invest in your parenting, invest in your friendships, invest in your life in a way that will make the future that you want in the next few years? And also the ultimate future. How can you invest in who you are to create the future of living with the soul that you want to be a part of, that you could be proud of the accomplishments that you made, the contributions that you made through your soul and its activities to Kali Soul. So with that, I'll open it up for any questions you have. Anything I know, I'll answer.
So within this perspective, how does one look at a couple? I mean, if we're not half souls, we are chips of
Right. We do have to look. Right. So for this in marriage, we do need to look at ourselves as two half souls. That is the best way to look at it, but it's just important to know that it's much more complicated than that. And that is, for instance, that's what propels Kiruv. The whole concept of reaching out to another Jew or caring for another Jew's spiritual health, is all about the fact that Mashiach cannot come to an individual. There is no ultimate redemption for individuals. It's only for Klal Yisrael as a Klal. So we have to make ourselves into a Klal. So we have to feel the Klalness. And yet, we have to work within our sphere, that we have the most sphere of influence, and that's our marriage. So for the sake of our marriage, we do have to see that unique connection, and it is a very unique connection. And we also need to know that it's much bigger than that. So Tehillah Yeager taught me that one of the concepts when we say, to rebuild the temple speedily in our days. The bet can be in, or the bet can also be with. Right? Bet can mean with. So, Bimhera Biyameinu, please rebuild the Beit Mikdash, please create that closeness that we're missing with my days. Whatever I do, my day should be part of that happening. And that only happens when there's the consciousness of the I affect the Klal, that my neshama is connected to everybody. So again, in marriage, see it as two half souls. But know that it's just much bigger than that. But you still have to work within your marriage, seeing it that way, and teach it that way. It's just bigger and complicated. So sorry to throw you the curveball, but just helps you grow and grow and grow. Hopefully next time I come, I'll know more, and I can share you with another piece. But this is pretty much what I know until now.
Let me ask you about the size of the soul, because it starts when you're 40 days, mm-hmm. and it grows. I assume that it grows with the body. What about the size? And is it possible for the soul to get out of the body? Because usually you hear about the out of body experiences. I mean, not only in dreams, but in meditation.
Right.
So is it possible for the soul to travel?
Yes.
I mean, around to other places and come back?
Yes. So that's what's happening when we sleep. The soul bonds are loosened and those upper four levels can travel. But that can also happen through a meditative experience or out-of-body experiences, but it would not be the whole soul. Because if the whole soul leaves the body, that's called death.
But they say that your soul goes to, let's say, if you're in a room and you sleep and you go to another country.
That's a piece of your soul. It's a piece of your soul. It's not your whole soul. But it is a piece of your soul, and you can experience it and bring that experience back. That is possible.
That's true.
Yeah, that is true.
And the size?
And so size. So the soul can't have size.
Can't have. Mm-mm. So when you're 40 days...
So when I say grow your soul, what I mean is conceptually, not physically, because size only relates to something that's physical.
So when you're 6 feet, or when you're just about being born, the soul is the same size?
Yeah. I mean, really, if you think about it, our bodies are the same size. I don't understand enough physics to be able to say that. But I do know that if I would understand enough physics, I would understand that if you take all the atoms in the universe, right, and squish them down with all the space that's in between all the pieces of all the atoms, all the, I don't even know all the parts, but if there wouldn't be the space and all the spinning that happens with all the atoms that spin around and all of that, it would all be the size of about a basketball. Everything. So we're not even that big. We think we are, but it's only because there's a lot of space in us and a lot of things happening, but we're not actually. But that's measuring physical. The neshama is not physical, so it can't have a physical size. There's no delineation. It's like saying, how big is God? But you can't say that. There is nothing physical there, so you can't measure it.
So the soul could be this big?
It can't be, because it's not that size. There's no size. Right? I mean, they've done experiments. People who have wanted to prove through science that there's a soul have weighed bodies before death and after death to see if they can detect something exiting. Right, so those people who are soul questioners, soul skeptics will say, see, you can't see anything, your weight doesn't change at all. And yet, anybody who's seen the transition between life and death clearly sees there's a point of aliveness and a point of death. Something left that body. Sometimes people can feel a soul leaving, and sometimes they just see the difference between alive skin and waxy skin that happens in a minute. Right? It's very different with the animating, but it's not a size, it can't be. It's an animating life force. So you can't measure that, but you can measure its power. But you can't, not with our tools, but not its size. Can't talk about size.
And when you're dead, when your soul gets out of your body, who decides, is it God the one that decides if you're coming back or not?
Yeah.
To be God? Or?
Yeah, God's in charge of all that.
Thank you.
Sure,
hang on one second
again.
I was just going to tell him that I think when the body dies, it's actually even heavier.
It certainly feels heavier.
I mean, I've seen people carrying bodies that are heavier when they're dead than when they're alive. I don't know why.
I know, so that's definitely true. When somebody's a pallbearer, when somebody carries the coffin, it's definitely heavier carrying a coffin than it is carrying a stretcher with a wounded soldier on it. Much heavier. But I think that if you put them on a scale, they weigh the same. It wouldn't make sense for them to actually physically weigh more, but it's much heavier to carry. There is something about the life carrying an aspect of itself.
And the other question I wanted to ask you was, when the soul leaves the body, and now it went up to Hashem, and it purified itself, and it got, I'm assuming it's happier up there.
Absolutely.
Than it is in the body.
Absolutely.
What's going to make it want to come down again the second time in the Tikkat HaMitim? If it's up there so happy, we get back to the body.
So that's why we don't go with the Rambam's theory, or at least I'm not, even though the Rambam, Yush Talmud Chacham, we're going to the Ramban's theory, which explains Olam HaNishamot pre-Olam Haba. So that it is strengthening itself, but it's not yet in the eternal bliss of Olam Haba, that it would have to come back from that. It doesn't. It has to come back. It's not a want to. It's not options. Any soul still want to be resurrected? Let's go. Nope. That's not how it is. It's everybody back in the pool because you have to be judged. So there is an ultimate judgment. There's judgment after death, after each life, even if it's just one. There's immediate judgment. What did you accomplish in this lifetime? But you can't actually judge until the end of the world. Because what you accomplished through your children too. And so what you taught your daughter, she's teaching her daughter, who's teaching her daughter, who's teaching her daughter, who's teaching her friend, who's teaching her friend and her daughter. And all of that accrues back to you, whether you taught positive or negative. So a thief, he's held to account for the thefts that he taught how to do that. If he taught somebody how to pick a lock, any lock that gets picked because he taught somebody how to pick it, that's his fault. And if he taught somebody how to be kind, give tzedakah, whatever it is, anybody who gives tzedakah because of his teachings, it goes back to him.
So what comes first, the Mashiach coming or the Tikkat HaMitim? I'm a little confused
there. That is a confusing thing, and it's not totally clear. Is it during the time of Mashiach? Does it precede Mashiach? Or is it within the realm of Mashiach? That's not 100% clear. But it is connected. So there will be. So there's different theories on that, and I don't know exactly. Nobody knows exactly. We'll have to wait and see. Hopefully we'll all get to see it.
Can you talk a little bit more about reward and punishment? Because
when you talk about accomplishments, it seems that it's like only about mitzvot. And what happens if a person is born who's a Jew and has no understanding of mitzvot or no connection to it, or a wrong connection to it? Like, what happens? Mm-hmm.
Everybody is judged exactly where they are. So we have that concept, and that's one of the reasons we learn about Yishmael, who is judged va'asher hu sham, exactly as he was then. And we are judged as we are now, and also as we are in relationship to everything. So we're only judged according to the progress that we make, or the regression that we make, from the position that we start out in. So if somebody is born, let's say, to a secular parent and a non-Jewish parent, or to two secular parents, or to two angry Jewish parents, right, who choose to teach everything negative, they're born onto a Shomer HaTzair kibbutz, and they have pork barbecue every Yom Kippur, right? And the kid grows up knowing that Yom Kippur means pork, right? But he's not the angry Jew. His parents are the angry Jews who made the Yom Kippur barbecue. He just ate the pork on Yom Kippur, right? So should he be judged? Is that fair that he's judged for eating pork on Yom Kippur? He didn't know it fast. And he didn't know pork is bad, right? So, but eventually he will be judged, not as a child and not even as he grows initially, but eventually he's going to hit on H.com when he's on the internet. And he's going to see, oh, Yom Kippur's coming up, there's something to learn about it. And he's going to hear. All of us have ears and all of us have eyes, and we're all responsible to use them. We're not allowed to be ostriches and put our head in the sand. So we are required to use our human faculties to be curious, and we all have a neshama that pulls us. We're all responsible to answer the call, and sometimes it means doing some research. But nobody's held accountable for if they start off in a negative place. It's just how much distance they cover, any direction, right? So somebody who's born into the most beautiful Torah home and they make negative choices and go off, they're held to account very differently than somebody who was born on that Shomer HaTzair kibbutz and just decides to be parved, right? He might actually get schar for not eating pork but still eating onion kippur. Whereas the person born to the Hasidic home who doesn't eat pork but just has crackers on Yom Kippur, much bigger affair. So Hashem's in charge of all that. He does all that math.
Sorry, it's because I just don't want to have like the image of a punishing God that judges you.
Right.
You know, it's very hard for me to.
Right. It is difficult. It turns out Hashem punishes, but not out of anger. So we do ask for Hashem to get off the kisei hadin, and move to the kisei harachamim. So we're asking for that on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, by the way, is a gift only for Jews. Rosh Hashanah, all human beings are judged. Yom Kippur, Jews are forgiven. So it's a special gift only for Jews. It doesn't mean non-Jews can't access forgiveness, but they have to choose different pathways. We have a very strong pathway in Yom Kippur. It does require some effort on our part, but not as much effort as you might think. So you do have to put in effort. But God can't not punish, because there are natural consequences. It's like saying, I don't like to think that if I don't brush my teeth, I'm going to get cavities. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't brush your teeth, especially if you eat chocolate before you go to sleep or whatever, you're going to get cavities. That's just the reality. It's not a punishment. Those cavities are not a punishment. There are the natural consequences of your behavior. There are natural consequences. The spiritual world is a real world, and there's consequences to what one does. So it's there, for sure. It's not that God is mean and angry, but he's fair. So how does it work when we say, please have rachamim? Anybody who has to leave, I guess, I won't be offended. You can leave. I know it's late and it's hot. But let me just explain this one thing for rachamim. So we ask Hashem to get off the kisei hadin and get on the kisei harachamim. The word rachamim, mercy, in Hebrew, the root is rechem. Rechem is a womb. The womb asks a question of the zygote, the fertilized egg, that presents itself, right? So the egg gets fertilized, travels down the fallopian tubes into the womb, and then the womb looks at that egg, basically, and says, should I bother with you? Are you worth it? Right? Now, when it asks that question, it's not asking about the history, because there is no history, right? It asks based on the future. Who can you become? Not who have you been, do you deserve it? Who can you become, do you deserve it? That's what we're asking Hashem for when we ask Hashem to get off the Kisei Hadin. We can't ask Hashem not to judge us. He for sure judges us. But we have to say, God, don't judge me on who I've been. Judge me on who I will be. But that's what we have to do. We have to make the transition. We have to take who we've been, work with it, and transform it into a new potential so that we can say, God, please judge me on who I will be. I have a lot of potential. Judge me that way. Give me another year of life. Don't judge me on all the bad stuff I did. Judge me on all the good stuff I'm about to do. But you have to really be about to do it. You have to really use that past as fuel to create a new future. And then you can ask Hashem to switch chairs and judge you from a different place. Yeah.
I would like to ask you if there's only one way as Jews to see all these things about this theme, or there are different interpretations from the big rabbis, and everyone sees these
excellent
things.
Question.
Or it's your personal interpretation of what you have read.
Right, okay, so we know.
Where is
a
real thing on spiritual things?
Right.
Or is only what you believe or you don't believe? Or?
No. So here's how it works. First of all, when there's two Jews, there's three opinions, right? That's the clock, right? My rabbi used to ask this question. He said, what's the difference between a Jew and God? God knows everything. A Jew knows better, right? So we do think we know, okay? So let's start with that. However, what I'm sharing is not my own opinion. It is the opinion of people greater than me. I did discuss a machloket, a controversy between the Rambam, Maimonides, and the Ramban, Nachmanides, two of our great sages from close to 1,000 years ago. So they had different schools of thought, but their two schools of thought represent the main schools of thought. There are little trickles of different schools of thought that do exist, but they're not the mainstream. How do we know what's right? We don't know what's right until we see it. However, that's what Kabbalah is. And most of this stuff is based on Kabbalah. So Kabbalah means the received tradition, right? And we received it straight from Hashem. He explained it. How did he explain it, though? He explained it very enigmatically, in secrets, but he also gave the keys to the secrets to certain people. Those people passed it on. Each time it got passed on, it got diluted a little bit. So we don't have the full transmission today. We are a little bit in the dark. However, we do have a transmission. That transmission is held in certain books. But the books themselves, you can't read and understand. Right, so for instance, the Zohar, not something I've opened or could read or understand, but that is a place where some of the tradition lies. The books that I access are more books that were written more recently, 1700s, something like that. So Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was a very young, charismatic, and dynamic Kabbalist at the time. At the time that he wrote just after the death of Shabtai Tzvi. Right, so a third of European Jewry at the time of Shabtai Tzvi, actually sold their possessions and were ready to go with him to the land of Israel. They thought he was the Messiah. And they were devastated when he finally died. He converted to Islam and died a Muslim. Devastated. He had a great publicist, though, who was able to, at the time, say, oh, it's just a test. Converting to Islam, he's going to come back. You'll see. Whoever really believes, keep believing. But anyway, he died, and people were devastated. About 40 years after his death, the Ramchal is born, and as a 20-year-old, he's very dynamic, very powerful, he's already writing books, even one of his students writes a letter to his parents, how happy he is to be learning with him that the Ramchal is taught by angels directly. Well, that letter got into the hands of some rabbis who said, oh no, we don't want another charismatic leader messing up the Jews. That is a big mistake. And they put him in Cherem. They banned him, and they banned his teachings, and they told him he's not allowed to study those things until he's 40 years old and living in the land of Israel. So that he was in Italy at the time. He moved to Holland, land of a little bit more religious tolerance, but he kept the ban. He did not study Kabbalah anymore. He wrote books that are not really Kabbalistic, but close to it, some of which I've read and I'm still learning. He wrote some books, and then he went to Israel at age 38, so he'd be ready at 40, but he died in a plague at 38. However, the way we Jews decide whose teachings are true or not is what stands the test of time. At the time that he wrote, his books were very controversial. Today, in hindsight, looking back, he's broadly accepted. I don't think there's anybody who says the Ramchal is wrong about what he's saying. Everybody accepts him as mainstream Jewish philosophy. And he studied in all the yeshivas around the world. So he is considered the arbiter of mainstream Jewish philosophy. Yes, there are some other smaller books and opinions, but he is really represents mainstream. So, and I haven't studied enough Rambam to really knowledgeably discuss the difference between the two, but the Ramchal is considered mainstream. So that is the Jewish opinion that as a group of Jews, we go by. It is not, and I'm not sure if I understood this in your question, it's not something that works according to what we believe. Meaning, we don't create our own reality of what the afterlife will be according to our own opinion. That doesn't happen. What we do create about our own afterlife is how we develop our soul while we're here. But that it will be affected by how we develop it here, that's a reality. So, it's not my opinion. That stuff I've learned, I put it together. I'm just the translator. Okay, yeah.
Just one question.
Okay.
Many people say that many people has good soul and bad soul.
Right.
Is that? No.
Everybody's
there
poor.
Is people that, I can heal somebody, and there is people who can heal.
I am not clear about non-Jewish souls. If it's possible for a non-Jewish soul to be born evil, I'm not sure about that, so I can't answer. But it is not possible for a Jewish soul to be born evil. Not possible. Leiv tahor barali Elohim, right? We're born with a pure heart and a pure neshama that cannot be tainted. It's not possible to even do something bad enough to ruin your soul. It is possible to do something bad enough to get your soul cut off from the Jewish people, and it will eventually go to destruction. That's possible. But everybody is born with the potential to create something out of themselves. And everybody's born with free will. So the free will interacting with what their soul is in their circumstances, nobody is born evil. Everybody is responsible for their choices. So, and their choices on their level. So if you're born into a difficult family, the fact that you take one step forward and you smile occasionally is huge. But everybody's responsible for the choices that they make. Nobody's born evil.
What about teachers?
Pardon?
What about teachers? Is that bad
soul? That's what I said. I'm not sure about non-Jews, how that works. Not sure. And he made bad choices. He chose himself into a very negative reality, for sure. And he's held responsible for it. You can't hold somebody responsible for something that wasn't their fault, right? So Paro is punished because he did the wrong thing. Even though it was his job to torture the Jews, he tortured too much, and he's held accountable for that, which means it was his choice. So even the evil people that we know will suffer for their evil because they chose it.
If
we're
made of chips
and
souls,
no problem.
Through this we can see why we can be a people and why they can be together. Why is there so much divide Jewish people but made of pieces of soul from
right.
the same soul?
Right. That is a symptom of our galut. That's really what galus means, is that disconnection. Galus means disconnection. Disconnected from our mission, disconnected from our tafkid, disconnected from our Hashem, disconnected from each other. That's what galus is. That's why it's still galus in Eretz Yisrael right now. Galus is disconnection. So we have to create connection. There will ultimately be connection. That's what I'm learning about now. There's the process of Gilui HaYichud. Ultimately, Hashem is weaving all of history into one giant tapestry that will reveal God's oneness through it all. But it's still being woven. He's directing history for that to happen. Eventually, as Yimalei's Chok Pinu, then our mouths will be filled with laughter. We'll look back and see, wow, it all fit beautifully. But it's hard to see that now. So we are living in a time of Pirut, and that's what it is, pulsation. Okay, thank you very much. Shana Tova. You can come here.